Hello and welcome to part two of this conversation with poet Jo Shapcott, recorded to mark the publication of her new collection of Mutability. I began the second part of the interview by asking Jo about her fascination with the verse written in French by the great German poet Rainer Maria Rilke towards the end of his life. I was curious to know what in his verse had ignited her imagination and led her to undertake a project that went far beyond the bounds of conventional translation.
I actually do think poets do this all the time, but perhaps less overtly than composers do, I think is my main point. The Rilke book is somewhere where I do work with another poet's writing very overtly. And it would be wrong to call them translations or even variations. To set the scene, Rilke wrote about 400 poems in French, which I was very surprised to find because I knew him, of course, for the famous huge German language poems. And these are much smaller and more intimate and more sort of frothy even, but I was rather fascinated by them. And I think maybe I wouldn't have had quite the freedom to work with the huge German language poems in the same way because they're so famous, so weighty. I began working with these poems as something to do when I wasn't writing my own poems. So it never really took flight as a project in my mind. I didn't even envisage publishing them. At the beginning, they were just translations. But then I began to kind of disagree almost with what Rilke was saying. And my poems became partners to his, a kind of discussions or disputations, to go back to that word, with him over points he was making in his own poems. So each of my poems has a partner in his poems, but it's kind of answering back or taking the discussion on further. A good example of that is a sequence he wrote called The Roses. In Rilke's work, he is addressing the roses, saying, "Oh, Rose, you are like this, you are like that." And there are about 27 of them. And it becomes clear that they're lovers, they're women. And he uses a very kind of restricted range of references metaphorically in the poems. Extraordinary. Petal, space, petal. Not much more than that. It becomes clear, too, that he's talking about female genitalia, not just the feminine, not just love in the traditional association with roses, but the body, too. My roses speak. They are the voice. I've also named them, which he never does. So in each of my tiny poems, there is the name of the rose in botanical Latin as its title, which was quite fun to research. And each poem contains some familiarity or reference with the rose that is associated with it. So there is this kind of argument, a dialogue going on. In the end, it's still a big love poem, like I think Rilke's were too. And maybe it's a love poem to Rilke in the end, even though it's a kind of discussion. I think what it reflects for the reader is that writers are readers too, and that passionate readers get so involved with writers that they move into our houses with us. And this isn't often acknowledged. And I think they become more real to us perhaps than the people we really live with. You lie in the bath thinking about what you've just read and having a little debate in your head. And I think perhaps my Rilke book just reflects that simply. It's a reader's book, a passionate reader.
Maybe that's an invitation for me to invite you to read a poem about Rilke coming to your table.
Dinner with Rilke. Stay stock still if suddenly the angel at your table decides to love you. Pretend not to look by smoothing out wrinkles in the cloth under the bread and ham. Offer him your own food casually to taste in turn so you can watch beauty as he puts an everyday glass to his lips. You can't help yourself, though he's avid for everything, eating, kissing, anything to become you, to repossess your house.
You write in the preface to that book about the question of how a woman poet is to relate to what's gone before. And I suppose the book in itself is the answer to that question. But in more sort of abstracted terms, what would you say you discovered about how a woman poet or you are to relate to what's gone before through your Rilke project?
I think it's a hard question. There's no doubt that still, what we understand as the literary tradition is essentially a masculine one, which doesn't mean I want to reject it. There's a kind of fascination for what's different, to paraphrase Yeats. You want to absorb it, to love it, to know it, to use it. And yet there's a bigger step, there's an extra difference that I think probably you have to deploy deftly, which I hope happens in the Rilke.
By going for poems which are erotic, you're kind of tackling it head on, so to speak. You know, it's an unavoidable question. There are perhaps other kinds of poets, other kinds of poems where it wouldn't be such a big issue. But clearly, as you described with the Rose poems, it's not something you can ignore.
You can't. And I think something that happens with these Rilke poems is they do ask the question about who is absorbing who. You know, one is in danger of being engulfed, yet also engulfing. The artist Helen Chadwick, who is the presiding spirit of mutability, talked really interestingly about gender. She had used her body extensively in her own work, and at one point in her career decided not to do it anymore because she felt, she said, it instantly declared her gender, and she wanted to be more deft. And I really enjoyed that idea and wonder to this day what a genderless poem might look like, whether it's possible, what it would be. In any case, always in my work, some of the personas I've taken have been masculine. I'm just fascinated by that as another boundary, another difference, that some things can dissolve, including love.
I'm going to come back to Of Mutability in a minute, but I just wanted, before we do that, I just wanted to ask you about the Mad Cow voice from earlier in your career. Well, is that another response to the same question, really, of how the female poetic voice responds to the tradition that comes before?
The Mad Cow arrived, well, as you'd expect, in a kind of disjointed, haphazard way, very like herself. I only ever intended to write one poem, but I think she ended up having 9 or 10. She stuck with me for two reasons. One is that she's kind of like a holy fool, like a Shakespearean mad character, in that she has insight into the world, into society, into politics, in a way that is harder for me to do by myself. The other's much simpler, that women get called "you mad cow" quite a lot, or at least I do. And I wanted to redeem that and turn it around and make it a good thing. So she's kind of feisty and sprightly. There's one of her poems where she's on a kind of European tour, does take in the whole idea of the male tradition, because she meets a series of famous poets. She meets Wordsworth. She meets Byron, who boots her out of his specially designed carriage somewhere in the Alps after making love. And she also meets Goethe, and she's desperate to please all of these men. But of course, this doesn't happen. And she's left alone in the mountains, listening for something else, I guess, which is a sound like bells, cowbells, or something else. So there's a kind of dynamic going on. It's dramatized there, but not solved.
It seemed to me that there was a connection between those poems, which are sort of performance pieces, if you like, and some of the pieces in Of Mutability, like La Canterina, and the final poem, Piss Flower, which again seems to be the poetic voice celebrating its own power, what it's able to summon up through language. Tell me about La Canterina.
Yes, La Canterina, she is a singer. In fact, this piece was written for the composer John Woolrich. He knew already that he wanted a song for a very virtuosic singer called Eileen Hulse. And he played me a lot of unusual Mozart arias, which were very, very complex and virtuosic, and talked to me a lot about the figure of La Canterina, who you might imagine is the kind of singer who would have appeared between the acts and done a turn, which would not necessarily only involve singing, but other things too, a spot of dancing, or just very skillful, unexpected collection of artistic skills. He fed me all of this ideas and played me a lot of music, and those ideas became the poem itself, and eventually the song as well.
And she speaks in full knowledge of her own powers.
Yes, she
and
does.
The,
yes.
The erotics of her own performance.
Yes. One thing little girls are often told, in a way perhaps that boys aren't, certainly happened to me, is that they shouldn't show off, and that showing off was the worst thing you could do. I wanted to reclaim showing off as part of this poem. La Cantarina. I can spring as high and nimbly as a flea, and I can execute 20 entrechats in sequence without pausing for breath, at each leap clicking my heels 8 times. I can do the same for all the entrepas, and I swear I make even the best of the rest a block of stone. I like to add a detail or two to any complex dancing, sometimes juggling, or often a song, mystical and remote, to split the mood. Performing on a tightrope makes me feel wanton, all the space underneath and the swaying and the dazzle of my own steps. They jostle to see my legs from below, and I might croon stars at them, the moon at them if I like. I love it when they believe in me, half naked, technical, distressed, and showing off at the top of my voice.
And the exuberance is in the language, and it's also on the page, and when readers look at it on the page, they'll see that that performance is carried through to how you actually set the words down on the page.
It's very much a poem and not a song, actually, in that respect, because it does. The steps are all there in the way it looks on the page and the way it sounds if you read through the page. That's all lost in the song, which becomes linear, but of course has something else as well. It has the soprano's extraordinary virtuosic voice.
Jo, I wanted to end by looking at a sequence of poems in the book which are among my own favourites. The sequence on trees, and they're completely different from that, which is very much a performance and a voice, and they're much more interior in every sense. And also, going back to what you were saying earlier, they exist in that sort of zone which is a border. It's between the self and the world out there, and explores the possibility of interpenetration between the two. Can you tell me how that sequence grew? What was the spark for those poems?
When I lived in the Welsh borders, I used to work in a shed at the end of the garden, and it looked out on a field, and across the field was an oak tree, and I sat there for many days, for many years, looking at the oak tree in every season and every kind of weather condition you can imagine, and wondered about it and thought long and hard about what it was, what was its nature. We project so much onto trees, we get to know them very well, and we project a kind of humanity onto them, which really isn't there. And that difference fascinated me, and the fact that my presence in the tree's life means nothing, but its presence in my life means quite a lot.
You talk about the tree remembering the seasons, then you correct yourself and say that doesn't
remember. Not the word.
Can I ask you to read both that and Cypress? Because Cypress is one of my particular favourites, because it seemed to capture something about the nature of language and what the whole poetic enterprise is about. But perhaps first you could read the oak.
My oak has memory. It put the wind which shook the sapling into the mass of its trunk. It put the prevalence of weather down Hunter Hill into its weighted curve across the skyline. That infestation of caterpillars was remembered by the leaves, which contracted and thickened the next year. It remembers the seasons, or at least the length of darknesses which distinguish them. Our word is photoperiodism, but remember is not the word, nor is it my oak, although I used to watch it every day when I lived across the field, watch it respond to everything, everything else.
Thank you. Perhaps I can ask you to read Cypress, and maybe to end with, we'd say something about it.
Yeah. The cypress tree, I wanted to write about because its presence, although it has a very strong visual presence, it also has a powerful scent, and its texture is very powerful too. And I wanted one of the trees to live through something that wasn't visual. Cypress. Visit it in the dark. cicadas are inside your head as your hand reaches towards bark. You feel the latent heat first, then the surface, scabbed with lichen you can't see, but know from the fizz where touch meets memory. Before all this, the scent, which is anti-language, only as it drifts into your body, the words slip in as well, and made of earth, air, sun, and human consciousness.
That seemed to me, in a very short space, to say a great deal about perception and poetic practice and our relationship with the natural world. I loved the balance of fizz where touch meets memory. That seemed to me sort of a pivotal point. But also when you talk about language, the scent being anti-language and yet the language being ineluctable, because that's the only means of perceiving and rendering that we have.
I think all that is right. And that the paradox about this particular cypress and my desire to write a poem for its smell and its texture was for me that it was a visceral experience. I guess the poem meditates on how far a visceral experience is anti-language or not, or whether it's part of it.
And by dint of being a poem, it gives a kind of answer, doesn't it?
I suppose it does, yes.
That was Jo Shapcott, whose new collection, On Mutability, is out now. She also read from her book, Poems 1988 to 1998, and Tender Taxis, her collection of responses to Rilke. I hope you've enjoyed this programme in the Faber Conversations with Poets series, and that you'll join me again soon for an in-depth interview with another of the poets on the list. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.